Chapter 7. Are There Limits to Cognition? We have established that the elements needed to explain reality are to be drawn from the two spheres of perceiving and thinking. As we have seen, we are so organized that the full, total reality, including that of ourselves as subjects, initially appears to us as a duality. Cognition overcomes this duality by composing the thing as a whole out of the two elements of reality, the percept and the concept, worked out by thinking. Let us call the way in which the world meets us, before it has gained its true form through cognition, quote, the world of appearance, unquote, in contrast to the unified reality composed of percepts and concepts. We can then say that the world is given to us as a duality, and cognition assimilates it into a monistic unity. A philosophy that proceeds from this fundamental principle can be characterized as monistic philosophy or monism. In contrast to it stands two-world theory, or dualism. The latter does not, for example, assume that there are two sides to a unitary reality that are separated merely by our organization, but that there are two worlds that are absolutely distinct from one another. Dualism then seeks the explanatory principles for one world in the other. Dualism rests on a false conception of what we call cognition. It separates the whole of existence into two regions, each of which has its own laws, and lets those regions confront one another outwardly. The distinction between the perceived object and the thing in itself, which Kant introduced into science and which has not been overcome to this day, originates from this kind of dualism. Following what has been said, the nature of our spiritual organization is such that a separate thing can be given only as percept. Thinking, then, overcomes this separation by assigning to each percept its lawful place in the world totality. As long as the separated parts of the world totality are designated as percepts, we are simply following a law of our subjectivity when we make this separation. But if we consider the sum of all percepts as one part of the world, and then oppose to these percepts a second part, the things in themselves, we are philosophizing into thin air. We are just playing a game with concepts. We construct an artificial contrast and then can find no content for its second term, since such content can be created for a separate particular thing only out of perception. Every kind of existence assumed outside the realm of percepts and concepts must be relegated to the sphere of unjustified hypotheses. The thing in itself belongs to this category. It is only too understandable if dualistic thinkers can find no link between the world principle, assumed hypothetically, and what is given by experience. We can give content to this hypothetical world principle only by borrowing content from the world of experience, and then deceiving ourselves about this fact. Otherwise, it remains a concept devoid of content, and has only the form of a concept. At this point, dualistic thinkers usually maintain that the content of the concept is inaccessible to our cognition. We can know only that such content exists. We cannot know what exists. In either case, overcoming dualism is impossible. Even if we import a few abstract elements from the world of experience into the concept of the thing in itself, it still remains impossible to trace back the rich, concrete life of experience to a few qualities that themselves are only borrowed from perception. Dubois-Raymond thinks that unperceivable atoms of matter create sensation and feeling by their position and movement. He uses this to arrive at the conclusion that we can never have a satisfying explanation of how matter and motion create sensation and feeling. Thus he writes, quote, "It is completely and forever incomprehensible that a number of atoms of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, etc., should be other than indifferent as to how they are lying and moving, how they lay and moved, and how they will lie and move. There is no way to understand from their interaction how consciousness could arise." End of footnote from Dubois-Raymond's book On the Limits to Knowledge of Nature. Dubois-Raymond's argument is characteristic of this whole orientation of thought. Position and motion are separated out from the rich world of percepts. They are then transferred to the notional world of atoms. And astonishment follows that it is impossible to develop concrete life out of this homemade principle imitated from the perceptual world. From the definition of the principle of dualism given above, it follows that dualists, working with a completely contentless concept of the quote-unquote in itself, cannot arrive at an explanation of the world. In every instance, the dualist is constrained to set insurmountable barriers to our capacity for cognition. The follower of a monistic worldview knows that everything necessary to explain a given world phenomenon must lie within this world. What prevents us from achieving such an explanation can be only accidental temporal or spatial limits, or deficiencies in our organization, deficiencies not in human organization in general, but only in our own particular organization. It follows from the concept of cognizing, as we have defined it, that we cannot speak of limits to cognition. Cognizing is not the business of the world in general, but a transaction that we must each accomplish for ourselves. Things demand no explanation. They exist and work on one another according to laws that thinking can discover. They exist in indivisible unity with these laws. Our I-hood, capital I, then confronts them, initially comprehending in them only what we have described as the percept. But within this I-hood also lies the power to find the other part of reality. Cognitive satisfaction is attained only when the I has united for itself both the elements of reality that are indivisibly connected in the world, for then the I has reached reality once again. The preconditions for cognizing exist through and for the capital I. The I itself poses the questions of cognition. In fact, it draws them from the element of thinking, which is completely clear and transparent within itself. If we ask ourselves questions that we cannot answer, their content cannot be clear and distinct in every aspect. It is not the world that poses questions to us. We pose them to ourselves. I can easily imagine that I would be quite incapable of answering a question that I happened to find written down somewhere if I did not know the sphere from which its content came. Our cognition involves questions that emerge for us because a conceptual sphere pointing to the totality of the world confronts a perceptual sphere conditioned by place, time, and subjective organization. Our task is to balance these two spheres, both of which we know well. This has nothing to do with a limit to cognition. At a particular time, this or that might remain unexplained because the place of our vantage point in life prevents us from perceiving the things in question. But what is not found today may be found tomorrow. The limits determined in this way are only temporary, and they can be overcome by progress in perception and thinking. Dualism mistakenly transfers the contrast between objects and subjects, which has meaning only within the perceptual realm, to purely imagined entities outside this realm. But things separated in the perceptual field are separate only as long as the perceiver refrains from thinking. For thinking suspends all separation and reveals it to be merely subjective. Therefore, a dualist is really transferring to entities behind the percepts categories that have no absolute but only a relative validity, even for the percepts. A dualist splits percept and concept, the two factors involved in the cognitive process, into four. 1. The object in itself. 2. The subject's percept of the object. 3. The subject. And 4. The concept that relates the percept to the object in itself. For the dualist, the relationship between an object and a subject is a real one. The subject is really dynamically influenced by the object. This real process is said not to emerge into our consciousness. It is supposed to evoke a response in the subject to the stimulus proceeding from the object. The result of this response is supposed to be the percept, which alone emerges into consciousness. The object is supposed to have an objective reality, that is, a reality independent of the subject, while the percept is supposed to have a subjective reality. This subjective reality supposedly relates the subject to the object. That relationship is said to be ideal, conceptual. That relationship is said to be ideal, conceptual. Thus, dualism splits the cognitive process into two parts. One of them, the creation of the perceptual object out of the thing in itself, is assigned a place outside consciousness. And the other, the connection of the percept to the concept, and the relation of the concept to the object, is assigned a place within consciousness. Given these presuppositions, it is clear why dualists believe it is possible to attain only subjective representations of what lies before our consciousness. For dualists of this kind, the objective, real process in the subject, through which the percept arises, and all the more so the objective relationships of things in themselves, are not directly knowable. In their view, human beings can only construct conceptual representations of what is objectively real. The bond of unity that links things, both among themselves and to our individual spirit as a thing in itself, lies beyond consciousness in a being in itself, of whom likewise we can only have a conceptual representative in our consciousness. Dualism believes that the whole world would evaporate into an abstract conceptual schema if real connections were not affirmed alongside the conceptual connections of objects. In other words, the conceptual principles, discoverable through thinking, appear too airy to dualists, and so they look for additional real principles by which to support them.